Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and well, let's get into it. This is a story about the sea. Well, and a few other interesting anecdotes before we get there. It's a story you know, but perhaps not beyond the blockbuster movie about it. There are heroes, and there are love stories that stand the test of time. There are also interesting theories about rivalries between the richest men in America, and a possible, but truly unlikely, but I'll let you decide, possibly a hit ordered by J.P. Morgan, who was set to be on the boat that day, but bailed at the last minute as his wealthy rivals, John Jacob Astor and Isidore Strauss, boarded the Titanic. This is a more in-depth look into the Titanic and some notable people aboard. It's a bit of a deep dive beyond Leo and Kate, and it's true historic accounts of these unbelievable stories. Well, likely J.P. Morgan ordering a hit isn't true, but for fun, we're going to explore it. So before I tell the unbelievable, albeit possibly drunken survival story of an unlikely hero, let's discuss some interesting stories of the time that mean something to me. Sources for this episode are an article on historylink.org, history.com, a book called Astoria by Peter Stark, and All That's Interesting article by Gina DeMuro, Encyclopedia Titanica, the article about Charles Jogin, who is kind of going to be the main character of this story. But before we get into that, let's go back a little bit. So John Jacob Astor IV was aboard the Titanic, but his wealth was largely due to, or rather started by, his great-grandfather, John Jacob Astor I, I guess. And the first story of rare sea survival involves the Astor Expedition. The Columbia River Bar is reputed to be the most dangerous bar crossing in the world. At ebb tide, the marker buoys are forced underwater by the raging water escaping the Columbia River at 260,000 cubic feet per second as it meets the Pacific Ocean. When the river meets the ocean, there can be waves reaching 20 to 30 feet or more, depending on the wind direction, pushing against the Columbia River outflow. In John Jacob Astor's quest to make fur trading bigger, more luxurious, and broader than anyone before in the Pacific Northwest, he sent a crew of men, some from the East Coast, and a few they picked up along the way in the Hawaiian Islands. He set them out to settle and build a fort for fur trading in the vast expansion of the largely untouched Pacific Northwest. Well, at least by Westerners, but you know how white people love to claim land that's not their own. But that's a whole separate story because today we are focusing on the sea. Two boats, but we are going to focus on the smaller one here, set out to set up a fur trading post for John Jacob Astor. The Pinnace, I think that's how you pronounce it, and I've been reading it as Pinnacle this whole time, and even wrote it into my script as Pinnacle. So I think it's Pinnace now that I've reread it in another article, but maybe I'm dyslexic. I've been reading it as Pinnacle this whole time. But the Pinnace, which was a smaller boat paddled by oars, and one Yankee named Weeks and two Hawaiians named Harry and Pete. They attempted to cross the bar in one of these smaller boats. While attempting to cross the bar, one of the steep toppling waves slammed into the Pinnace and knocked her over, spilling the crew. Two men were washed away, never to be seen again. And Weeks clung to an oar, fighting to stay afloat, while the Hawaiians, who were experienced swimmers, jumped into gear. They immediately stripped off their clothes, knowing that the wet fabric would weigh them down. You see, Yankee sailors and Hawaiian swimmers both possessed their own advantages in these extreme circumstances. While not expert swimmers and often not swimmers at all, the Yankee sailors knew the shock of cold water, and from all of their cold ocean seafaring, also knew of the state of drowsiness that foretells the slip into hypothermia. What the Hawaiians had going for them, besides their extraordinary swimming ability and centuries-old tradition of small boats on open seas, was their stockier body types and subcutaneous fat. Modern research shows that they tend to have a thicker layer of under-the-skin fat, especially in the upper body, than do Caucasians. And this would serve as an insulating layer, but when the warning symptoms of hypothermia commence, unlike the Yankee sailor, they probably wouldn't recognize them or know the warning signs of hypothermia. They were always used to swimming in very warm water. But despite the water's incredible chill as they swam beside the small boat, the Hawaiians managed to slosh water from the pinnace until it was buoyant enough to hold one of them. As darkness descended on the Pacific, one of the Hawaiians climbed up into the boat full of water and began bailing out the water with his hands. The other Hawaiian then climbed up and joined him. Much of this was taken from Peter Stark's book Astoria, and much I have shortened because I'm not as eloquent of a writer or reader, so I am simplifying now in my own words. And in the book, he also just calls them the Hawaiians, so I wanted to say their names that I found that are, I hope, are historically correct. So, anywho, moving on. So, Harry and Pete are in the boat, and they have managed to bail all the water out. They soon notice Weeks clinging to his oar nearby, and they manage to maneuver the boat near him. Weeks was now so tired and cold he could barely hold himself to the oar. The two Hawaiians tried to pull him into the boat, but their hands, with their fingers stiffened by the extreme cold water, didn't possess the strength to grip him. So finally, the two men leaned over the gunwales, seized Weeks' clothing with their teeth, and wrenched him upwards with their heads, pulling him aboard the boat. But now the true ordeal began. The three were very wet, very cold, nearly naked, and at sea in a small boat along a dangerous coast, smashed by heavy breakers in the dark of the night. The tide carried them away from the shore as light faded and the cold March night closed in. One of the Hawaiians, Pete, exhausted and deeply chilled, eventually laid down at the bottom of the boat, having seemingly given up hope. And the other also seemed to fall into a stupor, refusing to move. Weeks, despite the difficulty of holding himself upright, knew that he needed to keep rowing to generate body heat so as not to fall into hypothermia himself. During the night, Peter died, even though Harry laid his body over him in an attempt to keep him warm. This left Stephen Weeks and Harry alive. Sculling from the stern with his salvaged oar, Weeks tried to stay beyond the row of the breakers, hoping that there would still be sight of shore the next morning, hoping they could survive the night. When the daylight finally came, he could see the shore of Cape Disappointment, which is really a terrible name for this harrowing, you know, experience. But he saw the shore of Cape Disappointment no great distance away, he said. The two men summoned their remaining strength to pass through the breakers and beach the boat. And Fort Astoria was eventually built. But Harry had become so feeble and benumbed that he could not proceed. So Weeks helped him to a sheltered spot and covered him with leaves. Weeks then discovered a beaten path that led inland, and he found the Tonquin, the larger boat, floating placidly at anchor. They then sent a search party to find Harry, but he wasn't where Weeks had left him. Harry had collapsed on the beach and Weeks had put leaves over him, assuming that he would pass very soon. But instead, they found Harry early the next morning on the beach of Baker Bay, half dead at the foot of the rocks, with his feet torn and bleeding and his legs swollen. They immediately built a fire to warm him, and he also survived. So like I said, Fort Astoria was built, and then over a century later, another Astor would be aboard a sinking ship. And the most unlikely of heroes and survivors would become stuff of legends on this boat. And no, that is not John Jacob Astor IV. He sadly perishes in the sinking of the Titanic. But very quickly, I'll tell you the conspiracy theory about J.P. Morgan and his rich rivals. And then the very heartbreaking love story very quickly of Isidore and Ida Strauss before we get into the legendary Charles Jochen. So, supported by the wealth of his great-grandfather, who amassed that as a fur baron, John Jacob Astor IV became one of the wealthiest men in America, but not as massively wealthy as his great-grandfather. So John Jacob Astor, the fur baron, between 1763 and 1848, while he was alive, he amassed and this is pretty insane. The wealth equivalent to Jeff Bezos today, so $110 to $168 billion. So, while John Jacob Astor IV didn't become as wealthy as his great-grandfather, he was wealthy enough to sail first class on the Titanic, where a ticket was well over $100,000 in today's money. Okay, so one very quick conspiracy theory. So according to this theory, J.P. Morgan planned the disaster to kill his rivals. It doesn't totally make sense, but I'm just saying it for funsies. So according to this theory, millionaire banker J.P. Morgan planned the Titanic disaster to kill off rival millionaires John Jacob Astor and Isidore Strauss and Benjamin Guggenheim, who all perished aboard. The theory hinges on the fact that Morgan had originally planned a sail on the Titanic, but changed his mind shortly before it took off. Yet it doesn't really offer any explanation for how he was able to cause the ship to hit an iceberg. But I just thought that was very interesting. But the very cute, it's not cute, it's heartbreaking, love story is of Isidore Strauss and his wife, Ida. Isidore Strauss and his wife, Ida, were passengers on the Titanic when on April 14th, 1912, it hit an iceberg. Once it was clear the Titanic was sinking, Ida refused to leave Isidore and would not get into a lifeboat without him. According to a friend and Titanic survivor, when he offered to ask an officer if Isidore could enter a lifeboat with Ida, Isidore refused to be made an exception while women and children were still on board. While Ida is reported to have said, quote, "I will not be separated from my husband. As we have lived, so we will die together." So sad. Ida gave her maid her fur coat and insisted she get into a lifeboat. Isidore and Ida were last seen on deck, arm in arm, and eyewitnesses described the scene as the most remarkable exhibition of love and devotion. The ship sank at 2:20 a.m. So now for the story of Charles Joggin, the drunken baker, the most unlikely survivor of the Titanic. Charles Joggin was born in Birkenhead, England on August 3rd, 1878. His father died when he was just a boy, and partially due to that, and partially because children went to work at like age 9 back then. He started working on ships at the age of 11, which will come in handy for him later. He had over 25 years of experience on ships the day the Titanic sank. And the exact number of people who died on the Titanic is unknown, but the general consensus is that around 1,500 people perished when the ship sank. So he'd been working on ships for his entire childhood, essentially, and he got the gig of his life when he became the head baker on the Titanic. He's the baker at sea. And the Titanic was extravagant. The interior was often likened to a floating palace, containing some of the finest examples of interior design. It was like being on a 5-star hotel, but on the water. There was a grand staircase, several elevators, a heated swimming pool, Turkish baths, squash courts, a grand ballroom, a first-class lounge, and the first-class passengers would dine each evening on just an insane menu. So I actually found, I'll read you just part of their breakfast menu for the day and then part of their dinner menu. Then they have a luncheon menu too, but and they changed outfits constantly. It was just a lavish, lavish affair. So For breakfast, the first class passengers could enjoy baked apples, puffed rice, fresh herrings, finnan haddock, smoked salmon, grilled mutton, grilled ham, lamb collops, fried, stirred, poached, and boiled eggs, plain and tomato omelets to order, sirloin steak and mutton chops to order, mashed, sautéed, and jack pockets, cold meat, Vienna and graham rolls. There's so much more, but you get the point. It's a lavish affair. And dinner was hors d'oeuvres with oysters, cream of barley, salmon, some sauce I can't pronounce, filet mignon, sauté of chicken lyonnaise, vegetable marrow, lamb with mint sauce, roast duckling, sirloin beef, imported quail, boiled rice, punch romaine, roast squab and cress, cold asparagus, pâté de foie gras, celery, Waldorf pudding, peaches and chartreuse jelly, chocolate and vanilla eclairs. You get the point. It's insanely, insanely lavish. And this was right after the time where, just pretty much prior to this, even first class passengers on ships were required to pack their own, like, food aboard. So this is just, like, really stepping it up a notch. So Charles R. Baker, who was, you know, baking these extravagant delicacies and bakery items. So Charles is housed on the sixth of the Titanic 10 decks. He's having a drink in his bunk. It's his day off. But around 11 p.m., he feels a jolt, and he knows that this is not good. Charles jumps into gear after the Titanic hits an iceberg just 30 seconds after the lookout person rings a bell alerting of it. Charles then rallies his baking crew and tells them to bring bread into the lifeboats. He's worked on the sea since he was 11, and he knows the jolt he felt from his bunk is not good. Under his supervision, they brought over 50 loaves of bread above deck to ensure everyone in the lifeboats would have food to last until they were rescued. Then icy water started streaming into the ship, and most people were in a state of panic, but Charles calmly returned to his room and poured himself another drink. Having kind of getting, you know, warmed up there, maybe fortifying his spirits, he made his way to his assigned lifeboat. But instead of getting in, he helped a group of men foreswim. He said in his own words, he was literally throwing them, women and children, into the boats because people were kind of afraid to get off the big boat into these small boats in this freezing cold water. Like, they were just completely out of sorts. And he basically started tossing them in. So he doesn't get on lifeboat 10, the one that was designated for him in case of emergency. He just couldn't stomach women and children not getting on before him. And in his own words from when they did the sort of like trial type thing afterwards, he literally says, throw the women and children in. He's ordering, you know, men around to do this because they were seemingly lacking leadership, and he jumps into high gear. So he goes back down again and he has an even bigger drink. And after he finishes his drink in his room, the water is starting to fill up to his ankles. But he goes back up to the top deck, only to find out that all the lifeboats have been taken. There are none left. So this is when his survivor mode really kicks in. And this is really where it gets incredible. He decides to go down a few decks and grabs the ship's wooden chairs and starts throwing them into the ocean, thinking maybe they could be flotation devices for anyone that didn't end up in a lifeboat. Something they could grab and hold on to and hopefully survive. So he chucks about 50 chairs into the water, which I think is pretty good survival instincts. I don't know about you guys, but I don't know that I would have those instincts. I would like to think I would, but I think it's pretty impressive. Charles then goes up to the deck pantry on deck A to get a drink of water. And while he was there, he heard a loud crash as if part of the ship had buckled. He left the pantry and joined the crowd running to the poop deck. As he was crossing the well deck, the ship suddenly gave a list over port and, according to him, threw everyone in the well in a bunch except for him. Charles then goes back to the deck pantry on deck A to get a drink of water. And while there, he hears a loud crash as if part of the ship had buckled. And then he heard a rush over his head. It was as if iron was parting. So he leaves the pantry and joins a crowd running. The bow of the ship had gone into the water, and a wave of water rushed onto the boat and washes several people away into the sea. Ones that haven't been washed away are now starting to clamber towards the back of the boat, which is now pointing above the water, like straight up. I mean, if you've seen the movie. So Charles crawls up it, and he's holding onto the railing. And he rowed the sinking Titanic into the sea as if it were, quote, an elevator. Not getting his head underwater, in his words, his head may have been wedded, but no more. And he was considered the last survivor to leave the Titanic. But his enduring battle just begins now. He's in the water. The sounds of people drowning, the screams of over 1,000 people crying and wailing is unforgettable for the survivors.
There was no impact as such. It was just like jamming your brakes on a car. And that was that. She stopped. We had a porthole open and I looked out and the sky was clear, stars were shining. Sea was dead calm, and I thought, I don't know, I couldn't understand it. So I came out of my cabin and I thought, well, I go forward. And I went forward to the well deck on the starboard side, and I could see ice in the well deck. There's no sign of iceberg then, because it passed us. And the lights were shining on the water from the portholes, and no sign of damage above waterline. And of course, what had happened, we'd slipped over the iceberg, and although she was supposed to be unsinkable with a double bottom, the iceberg had cut her from forward on the starboard side to the engine room, almost amidships, right through her two bottoms. And we had orders to get the lifeboats out. And of course, the same old order, women and children. And we swung the lifeboats out and gradually filled them up. First boats were away on the port side. The first boats away didn't have many passengers on board. They were afraid to go down. There was a 70-foot drop to the water, and they didn't think she was going to sink. And a few of the first boats on the port side got away with half filled. Don't forget, we had 16 lifeboats, and they each carried 50. And if they'd been filled, we could have saved 800, whereas we only saved 500. So you can imagine there were many seats in the first lifeboats vacant. Then I had orders to go down the storeroom with a gang of men and get all the biscuits we could find. Well, when we got back up onto the boat deck, we couldn't get near the lifeboats. Some people were scrambling to get in, being pushed back. By that time, she was listing very badly to port, and we couldn't get the starboard boats down. But before I got my lifebelt on, I met a young couple, and I can tell you her name. It was Mrs. Clark. They'd spent their honeymoon in France, and we'd picked them up at Cherbourg. And she was having trouble with her lifebelt, so I fixed that on to her. And I said, I think you'd better get into a lifeboat. And there was one in the port on the port side. So she said, no, I don't want to go there. I don't want to leave my husband. So I said, well, it's just precautionary measure. You get in, your husband will follow later on. And I got her away, and that was that. And then I picked up my own lifeboat and put it on. Well, things went there, then the third-class passengers were coming up. There were 700 of them. And they swarmed the decks and filled up the decks. And I thought, well, I'd done all I possibly could. I'd helped them all I could. And I thought, well, now I'll go up and get out of all this scrumming and go on the poop deck. And she was sinking fast then. And all of a sudden, she lifted up quickly, and you could hear everything crashing through her. Everything that was movable was going through her. And then she went down and seemed to come up again. So I thought, well, now I'm going to leave. And I was hanging on to a board. We had two boards, starboard and port, which said, keep clear of propeller blades. And I was hanging on to one of these, and I was getting higher and higher in the air, and I thought, well, now I'll go, and I dropped in. I had a life belt on. And I hit the water with a terrific crack. And luckily, I didn't hit anything when I dropped in. There were bodies all over the place. And then I looked up at the Titanic. So the propellers were right out of water, the rudder was right out, and I could see the bottom. And then gradually she glided away, and that was that. That was the last of the Titanic. I didn't want to die, I mean, and I didn't see much chance of living, but I was gradually getting frozen up. And by the grace of God, I came across a lifeboat, and they pulled me in. And there was a fireman dead in the bottom, and there was about a foot of water in this boat. There was another man who seemed to be trying to get away from it again. I don't know what was the matter with him. They were tying him down. And the rest were women and children. And I sat on a seat, and I sat next to Mrs. Clark.
Many researchers suspect that people who hit the water died within an hour. Charles treaded for over 2 hours. He then spots a life vest floating in the water and is able to grab a hold of it. And it's now 4:30 a.m. The whole ordeal from first crash into iceberg is now around 5 hours. He then spots 25 men on a collapsible lifeboat who are all trying to balance on it by holding each other, and Charles swims over. Any movement or weight displacement could cause this lifeboat to go down. He tries to climb onto the boat, but a man pushes him back into the water. So he swims to the other side, and as a beautiful act of fate, the guy on the other side is a friend of his. He worked with him in the kitchen. He recognizes Charles and grabs onto him and holds him alongside the boat so he doesn't have to keep swimming. He's still in the water, but he's not having to exude as much energy. So for another 30 minutes, he holds on to his friend, and his friend holds on to him, until a non-collapsible lifeboat comes into view. And they shout that they have room for 10. Charles tells his friend to let go of his hand. He will be one of those 10. And he swims over. He gets on the lifeboat, and shortly after, the Carpathia comes and rescues the survivors, Charles being the most unlikely and last person on the ship, riding it into the water and surviving incredible odds. Charles Joggins' story and the story of the survival of Harry the Hawaiian and Weeks, who survived incredible odds, stands as a testament to human resilience and the unexpected ways in which survival can unfold. And how a choice to go down together, as Isidore and Ida did, is a heartbreaking but beautifully dark testament to love. So there you have it. A few, hopefully not too disjointed, stories of the sea. Thank you guys so much for listening. I love you. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Until next week.